This is podcast number 102 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today we're focusing on the Alhambra. I was debating whether to visit Holland or Spain first, but since we're celebrating Columbus Day today, I thought I'd start with Spain. And yes, I am one of the ones who still celebrates Columbus. If you're interested in my reasons, look for podcast number 17 in the archives. One of the big reasons I enjoy studying the stories of each nation individually, rather than studying world history chronologically, is because I pick up lessons I don't see otherwise. It's like our world is made up of many different families, and each family, when studied individually, has a story to tell with something to teach us. Some families are well-governed and have beautiful lessons to share, while other families are severely dysfunctional. But we learn from them as well. I'm afraid I have to place Spain in the dysfunctional lot. Not that they didn't have their moment to shine or that they haven't made wonderful gifts and contributions to our world, because they have. But they also became, for a time, one of the most hated nations in the world. Over the next few podcasts, I'm going to share some of the takeaways I'm gleaning from their history, lessons that can be applied even to what you are doing in the classrooms of your homes. We'll take a look again at what happens when you use force and compulsion, even with the best of intentions, versus allowing freedom of thought and tolerating individual differences. We also see what happens to a people when gold, that search for El Dorado and material comforts, becomes their god and the drive for their existence. How do we compare as a people when we have made salary potential the highest aim of our education system and the measurement of our success? Where might that lead us? Is there another way? Their greed led them to commit atrocities, but that drive also caused them to endure hardships that are nearly impossible for our modern minds to comprehend. But I see another lesson from it, in God's ability to always raise beauty from the ashes of our human frailties. Let's first stop by in this look at Spain and visit the Alhambra. Alhambra, to me, was a city in Southern California, not far from where I grew up. I certainly didn't learn about it in school. I vaguely remember hearing something about driving the Moors out of Spain, but I had no idea who the Moors were. I assumed they were the bad guys, and Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand were the good guys. It was while I was searching for books about Christopher Columbus that I ran across Washington Irving's Life and Voyages of Christopher Columbus and learned that he went to Spain to do research for the book. And while he was in Spain, he was introduced to the Alhambra that captured his heart and his imagination. The Alhambra was a beautiful palace in Granada built by the Moors, who were Muslim, and it was the last stronghold surrendered under the relentless pressures of Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand. It was their victory over the last of the Moors that allowed them to finally hear the cause of the Genoese sailor who had been following them from battleground to battleground for years. Columbus sailed the same year the Alhambra was surrendered. Because of Washington Irving's celebrity status, he was given the privilege of staying at the Alhambra for some time, and he soon took up the cause of preserving the grandeur and the enchantment of this beautiful palace through his writings, which became the Tales of Alhambra. Let me just read you a section from Charles Morris's Historical Tales for a visual of this magnificent palace and refuge. The rulers of France, England, and Germany lived in rude buildings without chimneys or windows, with a hole in the roof for the smoke to escape, at a time when the royal halls of Arabian Spain were visions of grace and beauty. The residences of the Arabs had marble balconies overhanging orange gardens. Their floors and walls were frequently of rich and graceful mosaic. Fountains gushed in their courts, quicksilver often taking the place of water, and falling in a glistening spray. In summer, cool air was drawn into the apartments through ventilating towers. In winter, warm and perfumed air was discharged through hidden passages. From the ceilings, corniced with fretted gold, great chandeliers hung. Here were clusters of frail marble columns. The furniture was of sandal or citron wood, richly inlaid with gold, silver, or precious minerals. Tapestry hid the walls. Persian carpets covered the floors. Pillows and couches of elegant forms were spread about the rooms. Great care was given to bathing and personal cleanliness at a time when such a thought had not dawned upon Christian Europe. Their pleasure gardens were of unequaled beauty and were rich with flowers and fruits. In short, in this brief space, it is impossible to give more than a bare outline of the marvelous luxury which surrounded this people, recently come from the deserts of Arabia, at a time when the remainder of Europe was plunged into the rudest barbarism. Much might be said of their libraries, their universities, their scholars and scientists, and the magnificence of their architecture, of which abundant examples still remain in the cities of Spain. The Alhambra of Granada, the palace which Boabdil so reluctantly left, being almost without an equal for lightness, grace, and architectural beauty in the cities of the world. Close quote. Why did I not hear one word of this in all my years of school? Well, that's a conversation for another day. I've posted a school edition of Tales of Alhambra, written by Josephine Brower in the elementary imaginative section of Spain. For today's sampler, I'd like to share the introduction to that book, which will also serve as a brief introduction to the history of Spain. And then you might want to read some of the Tales of Alhambra found in this school edition. I particularly liked The Legend of Prince Ahmed Al-Kamel, a story of a Moorish prince, a Muslim, whose father locks him in a tower so he won't be exposed to anything contrary to what he wants him to see. The same happens to a beautiful Christian princess in a land far away. But look what happens when love leads the way. And I think you'll know why I liked this little passage of the story. After years of careful academic tutelage, the prince, quote, completely abandoned his studies and took to strolling about the gardens and musing about the sight of the fountains. He had been taught a little music among his various accomplishments. It now endured a great part of his time, and a turn for poetry became apparent. The sage took the alarm and endeavored to work these idle humors out of him by a severe course of algebra, but the prince turned from it from distaste. "I cannot endure algebra," says he. "I want something that speaks more to the heart." The sage shook his dry head at his words. "Here is an end to philosophy," thought he. "The prince has discovered he has a heart." I'll let you read for yourselves what happens. And by the way, as a side note, the daughter of the developer of the then new suburb of Los Angeles near where I grew up had just read Irving's book when he was developing that land and suggested that her father name his development Alhambra, which he did. Now for the introduction. There is a promontory in the southwest corner of Europe which rises from the sea on one side and a once unknown ocean on the other, cliff upon cliff, hill above hill, mountain above mountain. About its shores, in Queen Dido's time, prowled the high-beaked ships of Carthage, hungry for trade. Curiously, their wily captains scanned the mountain paths leading from inaccessible defiles down which, in order to traffic on the sea beach, came tall, bold-faced Iberians. Having finished bargaining, the savages distrustfully turned away, remounted the stony trails to melt into the mist that crowned their vast and gloomy tableland. What was it like up there? The Phoenician trader wondered. Years afterwards, when Carthaginian generals had crushed many a hardy and liberty-loving race, the Phoenicians wondered still more. For the taciturn Iberians silently withdrew from every attempt at conquest. Up within those melancholy mountains, nobody knew how a race of men lived who could not be enslaved. One thing the old world empires did know, however, out of that unknown interior, four great rivers wore their way westward into the Atlantic, and as they fell toward the beach, they washed down gold. And it was the rumor of this gold that called those sailing kites of wealth, Carthage, Greece, Rome, the Goths, who make the first chapters of Spanish history. Each of these nations, in turn, conquered the green strip of Spanish shore. Not any of them entered the guarded heart of Spain. Her invincible mountain rampart rolled back the invaders as the cliffs rolled back the sea, while from above the ancient Iberians looked down an unconquerable manhood, silent, melancholy, honorable. By and by a fifth invasion came like lightning, out of North Africa, across the straits, rushing up and over the mountain barriers that had kept out the great races before them, came the desert-born Moors. They came like wildfire, scorching, blinding, and driving before them the old Iberian race until they hemmed it into the little northwest corner, where afterwards Castile and North Portugal were outlined. There they passed it by for a time while they poured through the defiles of the Pyrenees and streamed down into the green plains of France. The white barbs of the Moorish desert disdained to tread on Frankish soil, and as they poised their dainty feet in air, the smooth, still caps of the riders with their quivering spikes and floating green veils caught the sunlight and shimmered it away. Like a sea tide, the green and glancing Muslim host rolled into the history of Europe. In its path waited a forlorn army. Fragments and remnants of the broken Roman Empire had gathered together, dreary and desperate, for a last stand. Before them loomed one colossus, Charles the Sledgehammer, that day the savior of a continent. It was on the plain of Tours in the year 732 that they fought one of the greatest battles of the world. Darkness and despair, led by Charles the Sledgehammer, broke and shattered the Moorish array. Abderrahman was killed, and slowly and sullenly the Moors receded southward again. And now begins the romance of Spain. The Moors had come back to stay. They built beautiful cities, graceful palaces, and barren old Spain began to blossom like a garden. Famous universities arose here and there. Music, poetry, literature flourished under the kindly smile of the caliphs. But behind this smile of peace, the spirit of Iberia was gathering itself together up there among the mountains of Castile. The name Castile comes from the chain of castles which the hunted Spaniards had hung from cliff to cliff around their forbidding refuge. As soon as the Moors began to busy themselves in other ways than fighting, the gaunt Castilian knights began to let down their drawbridges. One day, when everything was ready, they rode forth, followed by their men-at-arms, their priests blessing them as they went, their anxious ladies fluttering scarves from the battlements and calling, "Godspeed, Godspeed," for they were going to fight against the infidels whose religion was a worse crime than their conquest. The old Castilian believed in the right of the strong to take what he could, but he never could be made to see that a man had the right to worship God according to his own conscience. Step by step, the unconquerable Iberian stubbornness won back its country. At last, in the very same year when Columbus sailed for the discovery of the New World, the day came when Boabdil, with a handful of lamenting Moors, surrendered the last jewel of their kingdom, the most wonderful palace in the world, the Alhambra, and left forever the shores of Spain. But the spirit of the Moor never has disappeared from Spain. Still he rules the Sierra Morena and haunts every watercourse of Andalusia. To this day, after nightfall, Spain is no Christian kingdom, but is ruled over by the caliph. The Spanish peasant who lingers too late on the mountain roads, bringing down snow or wood to cool the water or build the fire of the Spanish city dwellers, runs the risk of being overtaken and caught up by some phantom cavalcade and swept away with them into their caverns deep under the mountains. There they sleep an enchanted slumber by day, and with the night come forth to resume their ancient realm. And all this is why Spain is the most romantic country of Europe. The genius of her Moorish conqueror enchanted her even while she drove him out. The genius of the Moor enchanted her. She was ignorant. The Moor was skilled in every science known to that time. She could build just rude castles, and she loved the slender minarets and the swelling domes of Moorish mosque and palace. She could not help contrasting her dull gray stone walls with the glowing richness of Moorish stucco work, and her heart was wrung when she contrasted her rude war songs, her harsh trumpet notes, her massive religious chants, with the languorous and passionate music and poetry of her invader, his clashing cymbals, quiver of strings, the soft notes of the flageolet. The pride of the Castilian noble, accentuated by his honorable poverty and his high-souled struggle for independence, was shamed by the Oriental grace, the Epicurean serenity and courtliness of the benign Muslims. Lastly, his imagination took fire at some matchless stories that have held the world spellbound ever since the Spaniard retold them. It is this union of the stern spirit of old Iberia with the rich imagination of the Moors which makes old Spanish stories about the finest ever told. They tell of the honor and the dignity and the pride of the Castilian fighting noble matched by an urbane and chivalrous foe. They display the glow and luxuriance of the most flexible of the tropic races side by side with the desolate sadness that broods over those barren and sun-scorched plains, whose solitudes to this day are dotted here and there only by a few taciturn herdsmen. Their plots are full of the mystery and fire of the Arabian Nights, full of castles with secret passages, mountains with subterranean caverns, beautiful ladies shut up in towers, music coming from no one knows where, mysterious physicians who practice magic, proud young cavaliers in velvet cloaks, their swords sticking briskly out beneath, incomparable señoritas throwing roses from moonlit balconies whose arabesques form tantalizing screens to their beauty. Hard-hearted fathers become suddenly soft-hearted at the end of the story, and blessing runaway children. In other words, these stories carry us where so many great conquerors of Spain could not fight their way, that is, into the dreaming heart of Spain. A good many years ago, one of our countrymen traveled into this enchanted country on a sober errand of historical research. He was getting ready to write the life of the man who discovered America. It was this fortunate project which enabled him, 400 years after Spain discovered America, to bring it about that America discovered Spain. Washington Irving went to Spain in 1826. He was on a 17-year visit to Europe. He had been in England, France, Germany, and Italy, and each country of them, especially England, where he stayed the longest, made him think and write about his own country. But when he found himself across the Pyrenees, for the first time, he lost himself in a country which has suffered less from change than has any other country of Europe. From the hour that he entered Spain until the end of his life, Washington Irving was haunted by Moorish Iberia. It is to this that we owe a richness of style, a romantic feeling for the suburb, which, but for Spain, the father of American literature would have lacked. Some of the time Irving lived at court in Madrid, but best of all, he loved the time he spent at Granada in the summer palace of the Moors. There he wandered by sunlight and by moonlight through the flower-scented courts, listening to the tinkle of water as it ran unceasingly through the deserted corridors into marble basin and tessellated reservoir. And there, on the very spot where it reached its glory, he created the strangest, most gifted, most unreal monarchy that ever reared its fabric for a time in Europe. More pedantic critics than we may smile at Irving's gifts as a scholarly historian, but we who know that the highest and sweetest wisdom in every race finds expression in its legends will see to it that every generation of children in America shall be familiar with traditions as heroic and brilliant as any ever created. The author of this arrangement of Irving's Alhambra stories loved these stories when she was a child, but was troubled by the necessity of hunting them out from their context. Therefore, with rare and happy tact, she has selected and simplified some of the narratives, enriching them with Mr. Charles E. Brock's fine drawings for other children whose eyes turn eagerly to look through magic casements opening on the foam of perilous seas in fairylands forlorn.